Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mental Health Much, the podcast that talks about everything queer and mental health. Today, I'm really happy to have as a guest my friend Kiarmin, who's going to talk with us about how conforming is not serving us at all. Hi, Kiarmin.
Hi. Yes, I'm finally here.
After two full years of hearing me talk nonstop about my podcast.
Yes, I want all your listeners to know that I was here from day one when you were having doubts and you're like, should I be doing this? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe.
You were very supportive each time I had doubts. You were like, no, Vincent, your podcast is one of the good ones. Keep doing what you're doing. So thank you for either being supportive or lying really well.
No, I was being supportive. I enjoy your podcast.
So, Kiarmin, on top of being a very close friend of mine, you are, amongst other things, a social worker in training. So you were kind of already in our professions. We met through our network of work, but now you're going to be like an official social worker with all of the letters at the end of your name. And you're going to be recognized in Ontario as a real professional.
Yes, all of the letters. Yeah, so I was working in a nonprofit that provided mental health and sexual health and like for queer people. And then the pandemic happened and I was like, do I go to grad school or do I take a nap? And I did both. this is what brought me to this profession.
In that way, we had like a very similar life course in a way. Like we both graduated from undergrad and then worked for a while in non-for-profit and then decided at some point, okay, I'm going to go back to school and get some more diplomas and then be able to like take my career not only one step further, but also, I don't know about you, but I was happy to do my master. I was like, okay, there's clearly like limitations of what I would like to do around mental health and queer people. And I was able to like learn a ton of things in that way.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I should say that I have learned a lot because my thinking was that I'm going to go get a certification to be able to practice. But then as I started school, I was like, okay, there's a lot I don't know, which is a great feeling. This is exactly where I want to be. And I've learned a lot.
So apart from being a social worker in training, Kiarmin, tell the people who are not your friend, who are listening to this, who are you?
Yes, of course. So my name is Kiarmin. My pronouns are they, them, or he, him. I would say that, who am I? I am a non-conforming, non-binary person who is Iranian and... yeah, I think those are like some of the things about my identity that sort of like I like and they like inform how I show up in the world and my experiences. I'm an immigrant. I grew up in Iran and I am a West Coaster in Canada who lives in Toronto and really enjoys Toronto.
So is that, I've never asked you this question, but yeah, how is that mixed like in your head when you think about where are you from? I'm putting quotes around. If I'm someone on Grindr, do you like tell them about being from Iran or being from BC? Like how are those identities mixed in your brain?
That's a good question. So you're saying that if somebody asked me this on Grindr, or like if someone asked me this at a party, maybe something like that.
Maybe in an appropriate setting and not as the second sentence they say on Grindr.
Yeah, in an appropriate setting. Yeah. I think both of those things, like being from Vancouver and being from Iran, obviously have shaped my experience in so many ways. I feel like they're inseparable from who I am in a lot of ways. I think that my experiences have led me to kind of have this view of nonconformity that we're going to talk about. And I moved to Canada when I was a teenager, and that's an interesting age to move. You have both, and the idea of third culture. Have you heard about third culture? Have we talked about this?
We haven't talked about third culture yet on my podcast. So tell us in your words.
That's true. So third culture was, I had a friend who introduced me to this and she grew up in Dubai. She was Iranian and grew up in Dubai and then moved to Canada. And I think a lot of people who grew up in cities like Dubai or just like where there's a lot of expat populations. Like, I think this is where the term came from. When you're not your culture of origin, you're not your host culture, you're both, and you're not exactly both either. You're this like other thing, which then they call third culture. And when I was introduced to this, it resonated with me a lot because truly, like, my humor, the way I look at the world, the media, and that's where third culture for me comes from, is that you're not quite this, you're not quite that, you're both, and you're this other thing. And I am the kind of person that I've become more in touch in my like mid-20s with my Iranian culture. And I like started listening to the music that maybe people in Iran don't even listen to, but like me and my friends here, we just like put it on and we have a blast. And if somebody saw us, they'd just be like, you're weirdos. But I think that for me, because that's like being from that part of the world is so nice and so like precious to me. And like, there's so much culture that I feel like I wish more people would see so I could share with more people. So for me, it's pretty important being from Iran and being from the Middle East.
So did you do that thing where I think it's a bit of a trope where people move, especially maybe younger people, and they sort of like reject their culture of origin at first, really just to be accepted. And then a little bit later in life, they're like, no, actually, like, I want to be in touch.
Yes, absolutely. I did that. And I have so much like compassion for that. And like, it just makes so much sense to me. It's like a survival thing. I remember one time I was out, I don't know, grade 11 or something. I was out with my friends. And then my mom called me and I started talking English with her. Because I was in front of my friends, and then she was just kind of like, what are you doing? just like, and I'm so happy she did that. It was really important to them that we keep speaking Farsi and like we can still read and write Farsi. And at home, like, it was an unspoken thing that like, no, you're not going to speak English at home. Mm-hmm. You could, like, if someone's over that doesn't speak Farsi or something like that, but like, they made an effort, so we don't do that. But when I first moved here, yeah, I definitely tried to fit in both with my culture and my sexuality and gender. So maybe this whole nonconformity thing is a reaction. I mean, it probably is. Yeah, it's like a reaction of something I had to do to survive at some point in my life. That was so heartbreaking.
Well, before we jump into the topic, you know what I ask everyone on season two? What is the biggest taboo that is left around mental health in 2022?
I think what's coming to my mind, first thing that's coming to my mind, is that healing needs to happen quickly. And especially, this is especially true for people who are maybe are in the mental health profession or just like are in healthcare in general and know about mental health. There can be this expectation that because you have this knowledge, you need to not show weakness. Essentially, that you need to have it figured out. Whereas we don't really do that. If a healthcare provider has an illness or like gets a cut, we don't expect them to heal quicker because they're a healthcare provider. Even though we're like talking about mental health and it's like it's becoming acceptable, compassion is still missing for chronic illnesses.
So I'm hearing two things. One, we talk about mental health, but you better not let it affect your productivity and you better like heal really quickly and get over it and get the treatment. And second, mental health professionals should not be the ones suffering.
Yes.
At least for the long term with mental health issues, because we all know we're perfect and we never have any sort of problems.
Exactly. Yeah. No, those two things. I think productivity is a key word. Like, for example, at work, it's like you can bring things to people when they're solved. You know, like you can just be like, oh, I was dealing with this and then now it's solved and this is how I dealt with it. And then people applaud that and they think, oh, wow, we're so like progressive because we're talking about mental health so openly. But if you just bring an unsolved mental health problem about yourself to work, I think we still don't have enough space for that.
Yeah, it happened to me a lot as a mental health professional where people at work need to go on disability. And for most places, short-term disability, which is 1 to 2 months, is actually fairly easy to go on. And taking 1 to 2 months break is relatively easy. But then in long-term disability, first, people feel really guilty. And I have to remind them, like, this is not free money. You've been working for 10, 15, 25 years of your life and you've been paying into that. So it's not free money. You're kind of like getting the money that you've paid into that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fascinating to me that as soon as somebody manages to go on long-term disability, it takes barely a month or two. And then the insurance company contacts the doctor, the therapist, and everyone asking like, when is this person ready to go back to work? And I'm like, we've literally, like, this person is still feeling anxious about filling all of the paperwork. And it's just been accepted a moment ago. And immediately it's like, when are you ready to go back to work? What plan? What resources? Often people who work in insurance companies, sorry if you listen to this and you work in a long-term disability insurance company, but they're like, what resources exist? Can we send this person into like a group therapy? And I'm just like, oh, group therapy resources. Me and my clients had never thought about that before. Thank you very much for your insight.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like that quick fix. It's like, what can we throw at the problem? And then beyond that, it's that people do that and then they're worried about the implications of that for a promotion or for like how then they're viewed in the office. It's that aspect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does have an influence on how people are viewed at the office. It would be lying to say that it does not.
Yeah. Exactly. Unfortunately, it does. Yeah.
So you already touched on this a little bit when you were introducing yourself. But before we go to the first break, why was it important for you to talk about being non-conforming today on my podcast? Of all of the topics that in the 2 years that I said you should come on my podcast, this is the topic you ended up picking.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was hard to pick a topic, I think, because there's just been so many things I wanted to talk about. So this one kind of came out from a conversation I was having with one of my really good friends. We were talking about how has gender and sexuality affected my access to mental health. I realized that a big part of my life has been to gain power through rejecting the status quo. And I've done this sort of not super intentionally. And it has really served me. You know, it has really given me strength. And I wanted to share that, I think because I realized this is an important part of me. And I think that this is also something that can help other people. It's just close to my heart. So I wanted to share it. And I think that by non-conforming, more people than they realize can also gain power.
So like, as a teenager, you thought that by confirming you would gain more power, but then you've realized that's not true. I have much more power in doing the opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. And I say this, but also like I mentioned earlier, with the compassion that you do whatever you need to in that time and you know best. Mm-hmm. Maybe I want to introduce this as an option rather than a, you know, script. Because a lot of people, just the way we're brought up so closely with this idea that conformity means survival, sometimes we forget that this is also an option.
Okay, well, let's listen to some music for a few seconds and we'll be right back. We're back, still with Carmen, talking about how conforming is not always serving you. And I guess to start, we could just talk about what is your definition of conforming? Like, where does this idea come from? How would you describe it? And what aspects of your life do you feel like it touches?
Mm-hmm. So the first visual that's coming to my mind is being in a room full of people and they're all thinking the same way and talking the same way. And this pressure that I feel to also think and talk in the same way. So that's the visual that's coming to my mind.
Is that like a fear or is that a scenario that you feel has happened to you?
I think both. It's like something that's happened and it's something that then I have imposed on myself.
In what aspect do you feel like society is asking us to conform?
Well, the biggest one is gender. I think I struggled, but I have been in question with my own gender for a while. I should also say that like gender in itself is so culturally specific, and like maybe you come moving here as a teenager and then learning what's expected of a boy. I was also like, oh, I think that really solidified the performativity of gender, because I realized that I'm like, nothing's changed except my surrounding, yet I'm expected to behave in a different way.
That's really, I'm just curious about that. Which ways are boys in Iran and boys in Vancouver are supposed to act differently?
I should say this is just like my experience of Iran. I did go to like a private school, but like our friendships are less macho. As boys, and this is an all-boys school, maybe that has something to do with it. But like I felt like I had really close friendships with my friends in Iran in middle school. And the performativity of that, like, I'm a man, I do this, and like, blah, blah, blah. Like, soccer was huge, football is huge, but like, it's also just like not done in the same way that sports are done in high school here. So that is one, like, it's less macho. Boy friendships are more allowed, like boy intimacy is more allowed. Like if you just like hold hands, it's not immediately considered gay.
Which is so like funny to me, who's been raised in Canada and who has been influenced by Orientalism my whole life, who like has this idea like every single culture in the large world of like the Middle East is like macho and the men are this and this and that.
That is Orientalism, because I mean, like a lot of Arab cultures, or at least the Levant Arab cultures, it's also like softer. So I think that was one of the things. And then I moved here and I realized that gender is performance, essentially. Like I'm even as a kid, like I liked dresses and heels and just like things like that. And yeah, I mean, in my early 20s, I had a moment, like maybe a couple of months, that I was like, oh, I think I'm a trans woman. And then I, like very classically through gender studies in university, I came to understand that there's like agender, there's non-conforming. And also just meeting people who were being like fucking with gender, it put me at ease. But even after that, it took me a while. Because I thought, because of the way, that's the other thing, I'm very like cognizant of the way I present, the way I walk through the world, is I'm often read as a cis man. And with that comes a lot of privileges. So partially because of that reason, I also didn't want to take any space in the trans movement. I always just wanted to be like, oh, well, I just want to like be a supporter. And around 2 years ago, I met this guy who's like incredible. He's a trans man, and he said this thing to me, and he said, what you're describing is that you don't feel like you're trans enough. You don't feel like you pass. And that's an experience that every trans person has felt, because gender is performative, because gender is all these things. And in that moment, I had just like a switch in my brain, and I was like, okay, like I can recognize my privilege and also claim this identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how the duality of gender is something to unlearn very slowly, that even by unlearning it, like you're saying, you're like, oh, there's also people who are gender non-conforming, but they have to also look a certain way. So they have to conform into a third thing that I'm happy exists. Mm-hmm. But like, do I look enough like this thing?
Exactly. Yeah. And after a while, I just started to just say like, oh, I just don't. Like, I just don't. None of it. like, I'm agender. I just don't care about gender. Like, and also pronouns aren't, in my first language, pronouns are neutral. So for me, they never really, like, hit close. Like, if someone misgenders me by using pronouns, I'm not, that's like, to me, it's like, this is a problem. This is a larger problem that I'm too tired to wrestle with right now. And that's, I think that's the sort of non-conforming also applies to that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that by not conforming into the androgynous idea of non-binary, you end up conforming into the idea of like cis men.
Yes.
Yeah. Kind of like stuck between those two places.
There's no escape, except there is. Gender has been an interesting one for me. And I would say, yeah, like right now I have the best relationship with my gender and sexuality as I've ever had.
What about race?
Oh, yeah. Race is another interesting one. So that's also, I think, just by virtue of experience, I came to understand how arbitrary that one is too. In Iran, we think of ourselves as Iranian and also Asian. Like, that's because, like, the country of Iran is in Asia, so therefore we're Asian. And then when I moved here, I learned that I'm not Asian, and I was like, okay, because... And then this idea, like, there's just a lot of different ones. Like, then Middle Eastern is, like, something that makes sense because, like, sure, yeah, like, there's a lot of cultural things, but not, like, even that is not monolithic. So it's, like, even that doesn't quite fit. And, like, the idea that the word Middle East in itself is in relation to the UK and to the West.
Yeah, it's used as such, like, a shortcut. You know how people say, like, Africa is a country, mm-hmm. like people say Middle East is a country the exact same way. Oh, and yeah. You know what, like between Africa and Middle East, when I went to school or anything, I'm not sure exactly where one stops and the other one begins. And then
yeah.
Like, it's like swiping like generalization and stereotypes of like, I don't know, like Aladdin the movie, like when I was a kid, was my only representation.
Yeah, which is not even, I don't know, is that India? Is it Middle East? I don't know where Aladdin is. But you know, that you mentioned this, that you said that you don't know where it starts and where it ends. And I think it's because it's true. It's like, we don't really, you can't draw lines on a map and then expect culture and people to conform to it. Because that's not how it works. Especially that part of the world, which is like very old and there's been a lot of cultural exchanges.
How does it affect you? Because I think race is talked probably very differently in Canada than in Iran, and probably even very differently in Vancouver than in Toronto.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think for a little bit when I first moved here, I was not aware of it. It was just kind of like, okay, like I'm from a different country. And like, you know, you, when you first moved here, you don't really know because race has become so complicated in the West, and it's like also in North America, maybe more. And I just wasn't really aware of the nuances. I also didn't think that there would be as much racism as there is before moving here, because it was like, oh, of course, like it's Canada. Canada has such a interesting image internationally that it's just like, oh, it's like, oh, this is a utopia where like everyone's friendly and all these things.
And we've just reelected Ford for a second mandate.
Exactly. It's like bizarre. And then when I actually experienced in high school, like I had a kid in the library being like, oh, no, you go get the sheet because you're not from here. That was a moment that I was like, oh, okay, so people aren't fucking around about this. This is like... People just feel okay to be that racist. And I think that for me, it never felt right because Iran's history is also complicated, but we've never been directly colonized. And I think that has something to do with the fact that it's just like a lot of Iranian people, we just don't buy that we're inferior because we're not white. It's just like that just doesn't sit well with us.
That explains so many things about you.
Yeah. I just don't buy into it. I just like, you can make as many movies, you can make as many Dunes as you want. I'm not gonna... No, but like, you know, that's not to say that we're immune from beauty standards and all those things. There's still a lot of, you know, racism is so insidious, but like generally we don't buy into that. So I didn't buy into that. And then when I went to university, I gained words and language to describe how I was already like feeling in my gut. Race is a social construct and this is the history of it. This is where it came from. It was like created by European colonizers to then rationalize colonization. And just like a lot of it started to make sense. So I think I'm really happy now that that conversation is becoming more prevalent, because when I was in university, even talking about this, I would be met with a bit of like, what? Really? Like, is this the case? So I think that a lot of people have done great work that this is becoming more and more common knowledge. And... yeah, so that's another one that I like never felt like I wanted to conform to, because I realized, oh, this thing that you created, you want to call me brown. Yes, my skin is brown, but like, what does being brown mean? Mm-hmm. Most people in the world, their skin is brown. It doesn't mean that there is a shared culture or shared cuisine. So that's another one that I realized pretty early on. I'm like, this is not here to serve me. And the best thing is to just reject it.
Does it somewhat bring you closer to some culture that you felt like you had nothing to do with, just by virtue of, like, we call this chunk of people brown. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, now we have this shared experience. And really, we don't.
In some way, actually, yes. Yeah, that's that it does. And I, like, you know, I have embraced that also a bit, because I'm like, if I can feel closer with this group of people, then why not? So I do embrace it a little bit, but it's also just not, yeah, it's not inherent, but I definitely embrace it.
Is there an idea that you have to then conform to what it is to be brown in Canada?
No. Okay, that's what you mean. No, I don't. No, I haven't done that, but I wouldn't be surprised if some people did that, because, you know, labels are, of course, powerful, and we conform to the box that we're put into.
Mm-hmm. It must be hard, right? Because if you're in a party, let's say, with like five white Canadian people and like three brown people, probably the five white people are going to put the three of you into like one monoculture.
Right.
You're all like newcomers, you're all brown, but really probably the three of you can come from very different background and different cultures.
What is this party I'm going to? It sounds awful. No, I don't hang out with those people. But yeah. And, you know, like, that's what I mean. I kind of just, like, sometimes I'm like, sure. Like, if I don't really care about those people, like the five white people that you're describing, I'm like, I pick my battles.
Well, it was just talking about Orientalism earlier and how, like, this just means that everything that lives in the East is used as like the opposite of what we have in the West. So if the West is something, then the East is the opposite. You know that. I don't have to explain it to you. And so it would make sense for like all brown people in the room to be put in the same category.
Yeah, that's the other part that I feel like I haven't had to do those battles very often lately, which has been intentional, because I used to be very loud in my early 20s, and I used to be very vocal about these things. And after a certain point, I was like, I value my own peace more than other people's opinion. Mm-hmm. So I pick my battles these days.
Yeah. So let's jump into that. We talk about parties and being loud when you face discrimination or racism or any sort of those things. So I'm guessing being non-conforming has really influenced your relationships.
Yeah. And, you know, it kind of happened gradually, I think. And very much I started to realize that I don't really want to be arguing with people. I remember I went away with a group of friends. This was a few years ago. And like, I might have been, I think I was the only person who wasn't white. Maybe it was like five of us or six of us. And then one person said something that was like, you know, was off color. And then all the other people looked at me and just like, oh my God, are you going to say something, Kiarmin? And I was like, no, I'm not going to say something. That's one of yours. Take care of your own. Like, but it's this idea that the other people fully had the knowledge that this is not okay. But then they looked at me to then do the fighting. And I'm like, no, like, I need to surround myself with people that I don't have to work as hard to feel belonging to.
And you know that if you had not been in the room, these people would have just let it slide without saying something.
You know, maybe, yeah.
Maybe I'm being rough with your friends. I don't know them. Let's give them benefits of the doubt.
No, but what you're describing does happen often. I will say that, yeah. So I think that slowly I kind of just started to do that. And I think also like maybe that was part of reconnecting with my culture too, and like surrounding myself with my Iranian friends and then realizing that we know how to have a good time. Like, yeah, so I think it gradually happened. It came out of a need to not want to, you know, be bothered as much. And I start to surround myself with people who are also shared my quote-unquote politics when it came to gender and race and all those things. And also just my politics about, you know, productivity culture and capitalism in general. And maybe this part of like growing up too, also that's something that happens. But being non-conforming, I can look around now and think about people and see how everyone that's who's in my life in more sometimes one way or more than one way are also nonconformist and are also rejecting the status quo, whether that is productivity culture, whether that is, you know, white supremacy, cis-centrism, heteronormativity, just all those things. And it's a nice feeling to experience that, which I didn't have for a very long time in my 20s.
Right. And I'm assuming that now you've even moved from like your high school, university, so you kind of have a clean state almost for who are my friends in Toronto. And probably as soon as you see those, let's call them red flags or white flags, you can just like take a step back and be like, well, I have no attachment with you anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. I can take a step back. And at the same time, I can take a step back without the anger. Mm. I think that's been really good for me. I think anger has a place. I'm not one of those people that like says anger is bad. I think anger sometimes has a place. But for me, and I think also I will say this to any person who identifies as an activist, is that you need to learn to leave your anger outside often. Because when you come back home, it's painful and it's not doing good things to you.
Yeah.
And I think that now I can do that. I can see those red flags in people and I can immediately know that this is not something that I'm going to enjoy. And I can also have a bit of compassion and say that you're doing this from a place of fear. I hope that you change. I really fucking hope you do. But at the same time, I have patience for it a little bit more, which is serving me at the end of the day.
Right. So if we talk about mental health, yeah, you're right. Anger is useful because we need it. We need activism. We need action. Mm-hmm. But it's also really draining and everybody burns out because we could try to change everything in the world for years full time, probably unpaid, let's be real.
Yeah,
it would still be like the tip of the iceberg, what we're able to do. So it can be really, really frustrating.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I have so much to say about anger because it hurts the person who's trying to make the change. And
it doesn't really hurt the person that needs to be changed. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Like it does touch the tip of the iceberg. And also touching the tip of the iceberg is valuable. Any progress that we've made has happened with that. But yeah, I think that's it. Like it's just so important that self-care is really important. But maybe leaving anger out the door can be a form of self-care.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really important for people who are doing the most right now in the world.
Yeah. Speaking of mental health, you're a mental health professional.
I know.
And you are a non-confirming person. But also, I know, without naming specifics, that recently you had to work in a hospital setting where we know hospitals are pretty like rigid. Let's call them rigid.
Yeah.
How is your experience of that? Like how much of you do you leave at the door when you enter work?
Yeah. Yeah. Working at a hospital was really interesting because I haven't actually had that much like rigid work environments. I worked at nonprofits and like service industry, and it's been different. But this was really interesting because I came to appreciate some of the reasons why, for example, some days like I question if I want to wear nail polish to work or not. And being in healthcare is very interesting that it's about somebody else.
Yeah.
It's really about somebody else. So like you are providing care to somebody else. And if you want to adopt that mentality, then it has to be as objective as possible. You're not important. Your healing of the other person is important. So I think for that reason, like I just saw the importance of like not caring so much about my own self and my identity in settings like that. And at the same time, I realized that I was in sort of conflict. I'm like, do I think this because it's the status quo, or do I think this because there's like enough merit to it? I'm still unsure. I'm still like kind of figuring that out. But what I do know is that a lot of healing happens when people's humanity shows up. And I think with professionalism and this idea that And what is professionalism? Let's talk about that. It's really...
Yeah, that's so vague, but yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And like in a hospital social work setting, when I think professional, I think about, you know, like a white woman, white cis woman who is wearing a certain kind of clothes and like just comes into the room and like acts a certain way. But where is that informed by? And again, yeah, professionalism is vague. But also, like, we all have, like, a sense of what it is.
So you talked about nail polish, which, you know, I wear sometimes, but I can easily remove. But In this past spring, you made a physical change about yourself that you could not add and remove on a whim.
Yeah.
How was it to be so visibly sort of, like, not othered, like, but, like, visibly queer in a hospital setting? Did you find that you dressed more... like plainly to like compensate on the other side, or did you just embrace it
to offset it? I think that that was a good question. I think I was worried about it in the beginning, but I think I forgot about it.
Okay,
that is the other thing that I want to say, like maybe there is some of our own anxieties there too. I remember the first time I wore nail polish, I thought everybody was looking at me, but they weren't. Nail polish is like a small thing. With this one that you're talking about, it was like for the first couple of days, I wondered if people are taking me less seriously or if I am like coming into the room and like saying a lot by existing. And then I kind of forgot about it. And I followed the same sort of mentality that if I can show up the way that I am, people will know. You know, as a mental health professional, I believe the way that I am is, I hope, soothing and calming and compassionate. And I try to focus more on those parts than, you know, my physical appearance. So I am so hesitant to call it an act of resistance because it's so small, but it is. It's when you show up as a queer person and you show up visibly nonconforming, you make a small change. And I think that that's kind of what happened. And I forgot about it. And I tried to not focus on so much about like, what were people thinking about this and more about, how am I doing my job the way I want to do my job?
Mm-hmm. It can really have an impact. It's hard sometimes as a professional, like this particular job you were in, you were seeing people only once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when you work like my job more, like you work with people over a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And like each time I change the way I look, for a moment, I make it about me and not about them. So you're always have to, like, this is something I'm not sure I'm navigating perfectly right now.
Because you are the constant in their life in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Like, let's say I wanted to dye my hair. Like if my clients know that I dye my hair every time and I always come up with a different color, then they expect that of me. So it's no longer a thing. But if I never dye my hair and suddenly I do it, then it becomes a real thing.
Yeah.
So it's like either you change all of the time or you never change or you always change the same way.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point. And I think could this change of hair color or whatever also signify that, listen, I'm also human here with a life outside of this, and we're in this therapeutic relationship together. And that is exactly what's going to bring you the help that you need, because I am showing up with my humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've made some changes.
That's right. You have.
Yeah. So it you can do it, but it's always, as a health professional, mental health professional, it's just always on my mind more than what I wish it were.
Right. Yeah.
And it's normal. Like I've worked with some people for like 5, 6, 7 years. Like they're curious about me. They don't know much. I mean, now a lot of them listen to this podcast, I guess, which is a little bit weird because they get to know more about me.
That's right. Yeah.
In a way that like Freud would like,
yeah,
you know, die, but he's already dead, but he would not love.
Freud would be shaking in his grave.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and you know, I think that maybe that also brings up the question of like how we think about therapy too. And I think for me, starting when I started this program, my relationship with my therapist changed completely too, because I start to think of it as like, oh, like, they're not this like special person he's very special, of course. I really like my therapist. But like, this is not this like a special person. This is another person. And like, we're doing this together. So I think learning more about his life actually like helped in that sense, but you know, it's different for everyone.
Yeah. And you have to be mindful as a therapist that, yeah, the therapeutic session is not about me. It's about them. And like, they're actually paying, they're not paying to know why I dyed my hair and what is my favorite color.
Exactly. Yeah. but sort of to go back to your point that you were making about the hospital and non-conforming and professionalism, the other thing that's coming to my mind right now is that like, if you show up as plain as is expected, sure, it's going to make maybe more people feel at ease, but like there is also some people who will be at ease when they see that you look visibly queer.
Yeah, absolutely. It might be like with tattoos, like when we think like only like 30 years ago, just having a visible tattoo was like unthinkable in a professional setting. And now cops have tattoos.
Exactly.
Do like lawyers and judges have tattoos?
Actually, that's a good question. Probably, yeah.
I can't believe there's no lawyers or judges out there.
A judge with a face tattoo. That's what I want to see.
A visibly queer judge with a face tattoo.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to add on the topic of how confirming is not good for us?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk about this because I've realized very recently how big of my life this is. And another reason I think I already mentioned, but I wanted to talk about this because I think there's a lot of beautiful things that can happen when we reject these scripts that we've been given. So I just like, I hope that this has been presented as an option to live more mindfully and examine the things that we do and the scripts that we follow. Because I think for most people, like questioning that and seeing if you actually want to conform and then non-conforming is helpful. And I also want to say that for me, it didn't come from a place of like, I actually sat down and like thought about it very carefully and this is how it happened. It came from a place of necessity and just of my upbringing as well. I think my family was a bit of a nonconformist. We rejected a lot of like traditional things from a couple generations ago. So I want to like also recognize that that's a lot of why I am the way I am is to my socialization. But my hope is that I want to tell people, try it out. See if you like it. And by doing it, you're making a lot of other people's lives who are on the margins easier too.
Mm-hmm. Before we take the break, I have this sort of like question because we've been talking about non-confirming for an hour now.
Wow.
And we've been talking about it in a very like homogeneous way in the sense that you say like, your friends and the people around you are non-confirming, but they're probably non-confirming in a very similar way than you by like being on the left politically, being queer, maybe something about like gender identity, gender presentations, ideology, the type of like pop culture that we consume and that we talk about.
Yeah.
So in a way, is there like a conform way of being non-confirming and where is like the nuances and where do we exist in this?
There absolutely is. Like the left can also get homogeneous. The left, whatever that is. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I mean, like, that's a very, it's like a meta way to think about it. But I think for me, it gets summarized in having a non-judgmental open approach, like hearing people out. And like examining when you're presented with an idea or a way to be, like examining it and then seeing if this is something that you actually want to do, if it's something that's good for yourself and other people around you. I think that's the best way that you can avoid it becoming homogenous. Because yeah, you're right. Like being nonconformist, it's in itself, it's like, what do you mean? Is it that just like you and the people you surround yourself with think the same way as you do? And a lot of times it is. I think humans, to some extent, we just can't. We don't have the brain power to not have idea homogeneity around us because I think we want to be around people who we don't have to work hard around. But I think the distinction or the nuance, for me anyway, it comes down to the non-judgmental and to the critical view. So just taking a curiosity stance, a non-judgmental stance and just like really thinking about how much we want to project our values onto other people. I say that as I've been sitting here for an hour and telling everyone, be a nonconformist. Oh, did I haven't mentioned I'm a Libra. Oh.
Oh my God. We have to start recording from scratch and then do the whole thing.
This is where the self-reflectivity comes in. There's, I'm a Libra. But yeah, I think that for me, the nuance, at least right now, at this point in my life, is that it's the taking a curiosity and non-judgmental stance.
Mm-hmm. It is really interesting because even when we think about queer, and we were saying when we talk about non-binary people, we have an image that comes into our brain, and this image is a trope, and it looks conform, like in their own way. We have our own aesthetic, we have our own things that we do, our own like type of body, mm-hmm. like body shape, body size. Like these are all things that are always around the corner.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, let's take the break and come back for the last section of the show. Welcome back on our last section of this podcast, talking about being non-conforming and mental health. And Kiarmin, we already mentioned quite a few tips for your mental health or self-care if you are non-conforming. I think one of the one that resonated with me a lot was about anger and self-care and like being an activist, but also taking time for self-care. And that being an activist is not living in anger 24/7. Mm-hmm. What else is helpful?
I think the first one that I want to say is self-compassion is one thing. We have been talking about how being a nonconformist for me means rejecting the sort of oppressive scripts that have been handed to us, whether that's about gender, whether that's about productivity culture or race and ethnicity. I hope that people have a lot of self-compassion for what they've had to do to survive. There's no place for shame. I think that as people of color, a lot of us have done things to conform to white supremacy that we may not be proud of. And that's not our fault.
No.
Racism is insidious. You know, white supremacy is so insidious. We have had to do that to survive. And I think have compassion for yourselves and kindness for others also, and start small. You know, something that's just coming to my mind is that in the morning that you, when you wake up, you think you should dress a certain way, just go off script a little bit. You know, some of the sort of negative self-talks that come to my mind is that, oh, if I wear that, is that dated? And like the idea of that in itself is so ridiculous that it's like, okay, like if it makes me feel good, why does it matter if it's dated? So just like one example, because nonconformity can manifest in so many different ways, but start small, whether that's like the way you dress, whether that's like something that you think you have to do, but you don't actually have to do, and you just want to go off script a little bit.
I want to add to this about the way you dress. It reminds me of my interview with Zent, and like dress the way you want, regardless of the size and the shape of your body.
Yes.
I think it's even worse for people in like straight bodies or larger bodies or people who are fat to want to wear things that are out there because for obvious reasons, hiding their body or not bringing attention to themselves has been a thing to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, our bodies, you and me, are very different. And there are some things that you wear sometimes that I was like, oh my God, this would look horrible on me. And I think this is a very difficult thing to unlearn. And it would not look horrible on me. It would look different on me than it looks on you, but that doesn't make it horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It is a very hard thing to unlearn because also like body shame is insidious. That's another script that we've been giving. That's an example. That's a perfect example where we think that if things don't look a way that we've seen on television or we've seen on billboards, therefore it means it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I think my way of nonconforming also has been to limit how much pop culture I consume. And this isn't sort of because I want to be better than others or something like that. It's just that I, as a person who is feels marginalized in my identity in many ways, I find pop culture not for me. And I find it oppressive. And I find it that it plants those ideas that we're talking about, those like body image things in our head. It plants the ideals of white supremacy in our head. And like, as much as we may not be aware of it, I think it's happening. So I think just being aware of who we surround ourselves around and what kind of messages we're consuming is so important to our health, to our mental health.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's something you said earlier that I want to come back to, and it's about like learning the difference between what is uncomfortable and what is unsafe. Mm-hmm. I think these are merged a lot, and they can be... So I was just talking about clothing, for example, earlier. So I have a different body than yours, but I still do not live in a fat body. Like, I live in a straight body. And so for me to be dressing a certain way would feel uncomfortable, but it would not feel unsafe. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, this is not my experience because I've never been fat, but I'm thinking there might be some real safety issues into someone in a much larger body than mine dressing a certain way in public, walking down the street, because people have no problems yelling and treating fat people horribly.
Yeah.
And so push yourself to be uncomfortable because you need to unlearn, but also stay safe as much as possible. And it's not your fault. Like you were saying, like, you're not to blame if there are things that right now you don't think that you can do, mm-hmm. because it will compromise your safety.
Absolutely.
In the trans world, again, I'm not trans, but like the idea of like passing, and like, when is it that I play with my gender more? And when is it that I just want to go through a day without being harassed?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think there are moments for both. And you're not bad for sometimes choosing comfort and safety. Like, this is not your fault. You're not the person to blame. The people that are to blame are the people who are violent to gender non-confirming people. The people are to blame are the people who are violent towards fat people, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. No, that's perfectly said. Yeah. And also, just if you do something that's out of your comfort zone, you want to do, you want to dress and go out in a certain way, go out with a friend if that makes you feel safer. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when we don't understand something, our immediate reaction is to either avoid it or fight it. For me, non-judgmental and kindness kind of means being curious and looking at, is this really something that I do want to fight? Is this something I do want to judge people for? So, yeah, I think kindness, curiosity, non-judgmental attitude towards yourself and others is important.
One thing you mentioned too is how, you know, when you made that physical change and you were still being a professional with being visibly queer, and how that can really have an effect that you don't really know, like sometimes just existing in the world, like you said, maybe the person that you're meeting is going to be queer or have a queer kid or something like that. And it can really have a bigger effect than what we think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember so vividly the first time I met a person that just like looked like they were fucking with gender. And that has been ingrained into my memory. And I love that memory so much. And I read a quote somewhere that said, remember when you saw someone who was being like unapologetically themselves, you can be that for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I think that balancing that with safety that we were talking about is so important and so beautiful. It also reminds me of something else that I wrote down here, actually. It says, balance between euphoria seeking and fear avoiding.
Tell us more about that.
I was reading about this in a neuroscience class, but the person was making this argument that this is the human nature, that we are constantly euphoria seeking because of who we are, but also we want safety, so we're fear avoiding. So our entire life and the human existence is like us trying to figure out where we want to be in this balance and in this line. So in the same way, for me, being able to be unapologetically agender, you know, non-conforming person for somebody else is euphoria. That makes me feel good. And at the same time, if it's, you know, in a place where I don't feel safe, I am going to be kind to myself and I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to pass, quote unquote.
And it's not your fault that people who are uneducated about gender still read some of the way you present as male.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's not my fault. Nothing's my fault.
On that healthy note, Carmen, thank you so much for teaching us that no matter what we do in life, nothing is our fault.
Yeah, exactly.
More importantly, thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun, and I'm glad that we finally did it. And I can't wait to listen to myself repeatedly. And yeah, I love to hear myself talk. So here we go.
And for everyone else who's listening, thank you so much for listening. Do not hesitate to give us a review or a comment on this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Or I think you can do it on Spotify now. Exciting times.
Wow.
Until the next episode, please keep talking about mental health as much as you can and keep safe.
Bye.